Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. Our panelists, His Excellency Trevor Manuel, Minister of Finance, the Republic of South Africa. Andy Stern, International President, Service Employees International Union. Amartya Sen, Professor of Economics and Philosophy, Thomas W. Lamont University Professor, Harvard University. President Jalal Talabani, Republic of Iraq. Our moderator, John Podesta, President and CEO, Center for American Progress.
Good morning, everyone, and thanks for coming out bright and early. I hope for those of you who got to the concert, you enjoyed it. It was terrific, and we're going to begin our panel in just a couple of minutes, but first we're going to do what we do here, which is to, we've got a couple of really terrific announcements and commitments to announce this morning. First, I'd like to bring up Chris Crane, the President and CEO of Opportunity and International, and Ambassador Mark Irwin, my friend and board member of Opportunity International, if you'd join me up here on the stage. This commitment involves the Satter Family Foundation, Gray Matters Capital, and Opportunity International to provide loans to education entrepreneurs opening schools in disadvantaged neighborhoods where children's school attendance is exceptionally low. The commitment is for $10 million over 3 years. To fill the gaps in educational curricula and infrastructure in disadvantaged areas, Opportunity International is going to offer loans to dedicated individuals, providing them with needed capital to hire teachers, expand classrooms, improve infrastructures, and buy equipment. The Micro Schools of Opportunity Initiative is an innovative evolution from loans and other services generally offered by Opportunity International to micro-entrepreneurs in developing countries. This commitment will create a long-term fund to finance 5,000 micro schools in developing countries and is expected to serve over 1 million impoverished children by 2010. So join me in thanking these gentlemen for the commitment. Thank you. Now I'd like to invite Neil Lane, the Malcolm Gillis University Professor and Senior Fellow at the Baker Institute at Rice University, Rebecca Richardson Cortum, the Professor at Rice, and Sophie Kim, a student at Rice University, to the stage. Rice University is going to create a Global Health Technologies Institute to identify and create solutions to help achieve the health-related Millennium Development Goals. Rice University's Global Health Technologies Institute, it will coordinate research, education, and entrepreneurship activities related to global health technologies and education. The Institute will improve global health through innovative ideas for health technologies and provide service learning opportunities for its students. As you know, infectious disease accounts for nearly 25% of all deaths worldwide and extract a disproportionate toll in developing countries. Therefore, the development and the delivery of new vaccines to prevent infectious diseases in developing countries has become an important global health priority. Rice has expanded international collaboration in the area of health technologies on such as in areas of diagnostics, vaccine, and drug delivery, and water treatment with partners in Nigeria, Nicaragua, India, China, Botswana, Malawi, and Mexico. So I want to thank these three individuals for their commitment and to the work that they're going to do. Particularly to you. Thank you. All right, good. Mike? Good morning. And I want to thank you for coming out bright and early for this plenary session titled Promoting Growth and Fairness. I know it is early and it's the last day of the conference, but we have four remarkable guests with us this morning, and I think this will be a tremendously interesting conversation. Today we celebrate the fact that millions of people have been lifted out of poverty through the engines of economic growth. We may come close to meeting the Millennium Development Goals, which you've just been talking about, with just the number of people taken out of poverty in China and India alone. But with this growth arise many problems, such as straining urban infrastructure, the degradation of the environment, acceleration of global warming, and growing income inequality. The challenge against this backdrop of unfettered growth is ultimately building a vibrant middle class and securing sustainable long-term fair and economic growth. But as the world economy grows, so does anxiety about where the global economy is going. We see a growing gap today between the rich and poor in many countries, including our own here in the United States, and a growing gap between wealthy and poor countries. Can we pursue a path of more equitable growth, and what interventions are necessary? Today's panel will examine how countries are distributing the benefits of economic growth and addressing the burdens of growth so as to ensure that it is sustainable. Let me just give very brief introductions. You know all these individuals. Trevor Manuel is currently South Africa's Minister of Finance, a position he's held since 1996. He has served as chairman of the Board of Governors of the IMF and currently serves on the Commission on Growth and Development. The World Economic Forum selected Trevor as a global leader for tomorrow. Amartya Sen is the Lamont University professor and professor of economics and philosophy at Harvard University. He's an economist, a philosopher, the winner of the 1998 Nobel Prize for Economics for his contributions to welfare economics. Andy Stern is the international president of the 1.9 million member service in Employees International Union, the SEIU, the fastest growing North American union. And Mr. Jalal Talabani is the president of the Republic of Iraq. He's the founder and secretary general of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Please join me in welcoming our guests. I'd like to start, Trevor, with you. When apartheid ended in South Africa, you faced the challenge of a country with an enormous gap between rich and poor. Some people suggested that South Africa was at once a developed and a developing country. Today, the world, of course, faces similar challenge. The world's 10 richest nations, countries that comprise only 14% of the world's population, are 75 times wealthier than the world's 10 poorest. How have you, in South Africa, during these past years, tried to tackle that gap of equality? And what is your experience, I think, in South Africa, tell the rest of us in the world about that global gap, and what can we do to begin to close that?
Thank you very much, John. I think it's correct to say that there are still two countries within South Africa, a rich and a poor one. There have been very significant changes. We have a strong constitution, an incredibly strong Bill of Rights within the constitution. Within the Bill of Rights, there are some rights that are absolute, and that includes the rights of children. Our big challenges have been in the area of fiscal reforms. And amongst the things that we can now speak of, a fiscal surplus, but not with, I mean, it hasn't happened at the expense of social spending. Of the almost 50 million South Africans, there are about 12 million who receive social grants of one or other kind. 8 million of these would be beneficiaries of child support grants, which is a means-tested support system for children. Our education spending is now 5.4% of GDP, which places us at the strong end of middle-income countries. Our investment in the built environment is showing amazing strength. And I suppose one of the key choices that we've exercised is manifested in the fact that we're one of the few countries in the world whose military expenditure is less than 2% of GDP. In fact, the UNDP report last year suggests that we probably are one of three countries that spends more on the provision of water and sanitation than we do on defense. But, you know, with all of those good stories, The point that we must understand is that we're only just coming out of a situation where the effect of change on the poorest, the most unskilled of our people, has not seen a relative weakening of the equity position. So I think it's an enormous challenge. We need to be reminded of just how huge the inequality is. We know that we're dealing with poverty, but poverty and inequality are in fact two different issues. We need a consciousness and a determination, and I think democracy keeps us on our toes. Thanks.
Thank you, Trevor. And let me follow up with the second part of the question, which is advice to other countries. What has really been successful in your experience that you would recommend to other countries facing similar challenges?
You know, in the area of fiscal reform, too few developing countries focus on the revenue side. And this, I think, has been a remarkable strength for us. Clearly, as globalization finds root, countries will be less dependent on trade taxes and must be more dependent on income taxes. One of the big problems in the least developed countries is that the elites tend not to want to pay taxes. And so ensuring that everybody pays taxes everywhere, I know that it's an issue in the not so underdeveloped countries like the one we're in as well. The elites tend to get special benefits. No, we have to ensure that the tax take is adequate, and we need uniformity of application. That is a big strength, and that has given us the space to do things on the expenditure side of the budget. Thanks.
Thank you, Trevor. And I know Secretary Rubin is in one of the other rooms here, and we were joking with each other that he thought that there needed to be somebody who stood up for non-fairness, and I think that, of course, was not his experience as Secretary Treasurer. Dr. Sen, I'd like to actually turn to you. You've written, and to follow on to the conversation, you've written that freedom and economic development are intertwined, and that freedom means in no small measure that people have the capabilities, tools, and access needed to achieve economic mobility. If we want growth and fairness, what kind of freedom are we striving for? And maybe particularly reflect on the Chinese experience, if you might.
Well, is this all right?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I think basically I take a fairly wide view of freedom, which includes not only things like liberty, freedom from arbitrary arrest, and right to habeas corpus and so on, but also freedom to be educated, to be well fed, and to receive medical care when you need it, and to have epidemiological care. And that, of course, is central both because they make a huge difference to human life in general, which is, after all, the objective of economic growth, but it also, in turn, feeds into the process of economic expansion, because people's ability to do their jobs, their ability to participate and earn an income for themselves and help others to earn an income is also enhanced by these freedoms. So there is a kind of basic interdependence of a positive kind here. I think when a growth process happens, we have to look at two things. One is, how is the income generated being divided between the different groups of people? Because it's easy to have very high growth in parts of the economy, which make the overall numbers look good, whereas a lot of people could be left behind. And to some extent, that's happened in China, and to some extent in India too. The other is to see, and Trevor already referred to that, the issue of taxes and how public resources are generated. And it's a question of using these public resources. And I think it's very appropriate that we should pay special attention to the second, because this is something on which the government can do something with speed and some efficiency. I think you mentioned about China. The Chinese had this oddity that until 79, they had very low rate of economic growth, but a very high expansion of basic education, basic health care. By 1979, when economic reform came, Chinese life expectancy was already at 68 years. Since then, it's slowed a lot, despite the fact that the economic growth rate has been much faster. One of the things that happened in 79, the Chinese suddenly abolished the entitlement to health care of everyone, which every Chinese had until that moment. Instead of that, you had to buy a private health insurance, rather like what you have in the United States today. And that certainly led to an enormous slowing down of the life expectancy expansion. That's gone from 68 to 71, 72 years, whereas in most of the rest of the world, it's gone way ahead. Even the gap between India, which was then 54 and is now 6, is now more like 64, 65. The gap is reduced. And there are parts of India like Kerala, where the life expectancy is 76, which is way above that of China. The infant mortality of China in 79 was 37. It was the same in Kerala, 37. Today, China, it's 28, whereas in Kerala, it's 12. So if that had been possible, that oddity, that high growth rate had gone with slowdown of progress in life expectancy and infant mortality reduction, has been possible because of not paying adequate attention to the public resource use that it could have generated. To some extent, that problem is present in India, too. One of the things that's happening right now in India is that, at last, of course, the growth rate has speeded up from being about 3% and 5% and 8%, now touching 9%. But one of the things, happily, is that the rate of expansion of public resources at constant prices is about 10 to 12%, which is much faster than GNP growth. But it's a question of being able to use that for basic education, basic health care, and I think there's a huge gap there. Partly, I think the government needs more determination. So far, the program has been very much reducing government activity in the licensed Raj, and as it used to be called, the licensed Raj, the government controlling everything, to giving more private enterprise initiative. That's quite right. And at the same time, we need more determination in spending more in elementary education, elementary health care. And there is an enormous problem of inefficiency in the delivery of health care and education. There isn't the kind of ideological thing that hit China in 79 when they suddenly lost all faith in the non-market system at all, and which I think cost China a lot. I think the Chinese are very aware of that. Every time I go to Beijing, I see new signs that they are rising to the challenge. But Indians have something to learn from that problem that China has, and in many ways, of course, India has learned a lot from China. There are other things, not only from successes of China, but also from the difficulties that the Chinese have faced.
If I might briefly follow up with respect to the health statistics, your suggestion is that the failure to invest in health infrastructure resources has caused that. What about environmental degradation? Do you associate that?
Well, I do. I think that's a huge problem. Its impact on life expectancy and infant mortality is still very low, but it won't remain like that. These are the very early days for that. I think what we're seeing in the numbers, if my analysis is right, is primarily the impact of the change of the financing of especially healthcare in the period of marketization. I mean, China needed more markets, absolutely, for industrial expansion and agricultural expansion, and did beautifully well out of that. On the other hand, they also needed to keep the governmental commitment to healthcare and education. To some extent, education, they have kept it, but in healthcare, it slackened a lot, and they're trying to rectify it, and I think that's a move in the right direction.
President Talabani, Amartya linked the question of freedom to human security and the access to healthcare and education. You face, obviously, a real challenge in physical security. We've had a vibrant debate in this year on the question of what comes first, security or political reconciliation. I'd like to turn the question to security and development. I'd like to know, obviously each cannot exist in isolation without reference to the other, but today in Iraq, what can be done to actually grow the economy, and can economic growth actually contribute to the security environment?
Ladies and gentlemen, the question is not those questions, it's many questions. For that, I apologize to spoke in details to answer these questions. I think you know that Iraq is a very important country. Iraq is a middle of Middle East, and also we have in Iraq all kinds of natural resources, gas, oil, gold, everything in the country is available. We have also seven rivers irrigating the Iraqi lands, but we hadn't democracy and freedom in the past. Our dictatorship spent all the money and wealth of Iraq in rearming, building a very big, huge army, launching wars of aggression against Kuwait, against Iran, against its people. They left behind mass graves with hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis. And the economy was destroyed. The agriculture was destroyed. Thousands and thousands of villages were destroyed totally. Many small towns in Kurdistan were also destroyed. So we are starting from zero. The importance of Iraq also is attracting the attention of many countries around Iraq, because a democratic, stable Iraq will be a good example for the people of Middle East who are suffering from the lack of democracy and freedom. So we have many enemies, mainly those who are hating democracy and against the Federation. The new Iraq facing a kind of foreign invasion, a terrorist mainly came from outside the country. Al-Qaeda and other terrorists, they have supporters and their sources of even men are from outside. Thousands and thousands of non-Iraqis invaded our country and participated in the war against Iraqi people and against the new regime. Now the situation is changed. On the security, the Iraqi people started to understand the dangerous activities of the terrorists in terrorism in the country. Among Sunni society, there is a new kind of feeling toward the United States and Iran. Before, they were considering the United States as the main enemy, so they gave all kind of facilities to terrorist groups to come and to fight against American and against Iraqi government. Nowadays, the change is that they no more thinking that Iran, United States is the main danger. They consider Iran as main danger. So they are now trying to cooperate with the American forces against terrorism. The second important development that local people started to understand the importance of peace and stability for developing, for the normal life. So they started to cooperate with the security forces against terrorism. And many areas, in many areas, thousands and thousands of local people started to cooperate with the security forces, with the American forces against terrorism. And many important areas were liberated totally from terrorists like Anbar. And I must mention first that the Iraqi Kurdistan, with 4 million population, which is now ruled by the local government, by the federal regional government of Kurdistan, is from the beginning of liberation of Iraq, is stable and secured. So the development there is going very speedy. If anyone wants to come to see Iraqi Kurdistan, he will see there hundreds and hundreds of companies from all parts of the world, from Japan to United States of America, working, investing, and producing and trading. So this area is calm, quiet, and the big development happened there on all levels of the life. Excuse me, permit me to give you some number of education developments at that area. From the I will give you the number of schools and universities. At the time of the dictatorship, we had only one university. Nowadays, in that area, we have 8 universities, among it the American University and the French University. Altogether, we had 954 schools. Nowadays, we have 4,321 schools. We had and the past only two institutes. Today we have 27 institutes in this area. We had, as I told you, one technology institute. Nowadays we have 18. The number of professors and teachers was 617. Nowadays we have 3,894 professors and teachers in the universities. The number of students in the universities was at that time 7,027. Today there are 56,839. The number of students this year will be about 1.5 million students in all schools in that area. Also, all villages and towns, small towns, were destroyed by the dictatorship. Nowadays, all have been reconstructed or have reconstructed at least, and the agricultural life started. Many companies are started to be rebuilt now by foreign companies because there is freedom for all who want to come to work there. Now we have in Iraqi Kurdistan American companies, Chinese companies, Egyptians, and the construction is going very well. Some friends who came to visit us and they visited us years ago, they didn't recognize the new development in the area. And also, there are security also. The area is secured. There is no activities of terrorism. And other parts of Iraq also, we have liberated many parts. South of Iraq is also now secured. There is some militia. Now this militia stopped their activities. So we can say that north and south of Iraq are secured. And the economic life started there. Teachers, schools, hospitals are working very actively. We have another fact that even in Baghdad, which was the main battlefield for terrorists, now the biggest part of Baghdad is liberated from terrorism. Baghdad was 507 sections. It is now 500 liberated, only 7 remained in trouble. In the south, west part, as I told you, Anbar is a big part, the third part of Iraq, is also liberated from terrorism. So we have good steps in securing the country, but we haven't the same progress in the political reconciliation.
Mr. President, I want to get Andy into the conversation, but can I ask you just one follow-up on the Kurdistan situation? Just this month, Hunt Oil signed a deal with the Kurdistan regional government to develop the oil and gas resources there. That's been controversial both inside Iraq to some extent in the United States. Has the regional government there really just decided to go its own way, not wait for the political reconciliation for the oil law to develop its own resources? Are we going to see more of that, just the breaking away of the economy of Kurdistan?
Yes, you know, this is possible. And I'd like to say that according to the Constitution, Article 111 and 112, the revenue of oil is national, is for all Iraqis. It's not for the regional government or for areas which are producing the oil. But the administration of companies or contracting with foreign companies is a right of the regional government. So now, as you mentioned, the Kurdistan regional government had signed two kinds of contracts, one with a Turkish-American company and the other with the American company. And it's open for other countries to come, and we invited and appealed to everyone to come to see, because the area is very rich of oil. Unfortunately, I want to correct one thing. Unfortunately, the propaganda only concentrating on Kirkuk. Kirkuk is not the main source of the oil in Iraq. It was in the past. But nowadays, all Iraqi Kurdistan are full of oil. In some places, the oil in some places, Bata, than the Kirkuk's oil. And Kirkuk's oil is going to be dry because it has been used since more than 70 years. But for propaganda, it's used like this. So there is possibility for all companies to come to produce and to invest, and the regional government is ready to give all kind of facilities for them. Of course, central government must register and must agree, but I think they are also doing the best, because according to the law, which is now in parliament, the law of oil and distribution of revenues, unanimously adopted in the Council of Ministers and sent to Parliament to discuss it and adopt it. I think it will be before the end of this year, this law will be also adopted by the Parliament.
I want to come back from Iraq and go to the Globe and ask Andy Stern a question. Today, the global economy is really dominated by national governments, by international corporations, by international finance. I think the power, I think you probably would agree with me, the power of workers and unions in that framework has certainly seems to be have been diminished over the past several decades. Do you believe that there is a different balance that could be struck that would provide a more equitable distribution of wealth, not just here in the United States, but between developed and developing countries? There are 2 billion people living on less than $2 a day. What's the framework to bring workers into the system?
The first framework is, I think there is a big context for this. There was a very wise president we once had that said we need to build a bridge to the 21st century. And I don't think our country, I don't think the rest of the world appreciates we're living through the most profound, significant, transformative economic revolution in the history of the world. And that's a mouthful to say, and I don't think we quite get it yet. There's only been 3 major economic revolutions. You know, it took 3,000 years for the agricultural, 300 years for the industrial, and this revolution's only going to take 30 years, and no single generation of people have ever witnessed so much change. And so one is, I don't think we've quite yet conceptualized, you know, the difference here between now and other periods in of our history. Two is, I think we now know the contour of what this all means, where inequality and fairness becomes a problem. We have a integrating global market. The world is becoming flat. We have, certainly in the United States, the first real economic and military competitor in China that we've ever seen. But more importantly, as you said, John, I think more and more we're seeing companies, not countries, make the rules of the global economy. And even when you hear all the conversations, it's sort of what can government do on a national level? And I think that's the problem. Of the 100 largest economic entities in the world, 53 are countries and 47 are companies. And we have the capital and labor problem, and of course we have the growing inequality. Now, in our country, we used to rely on certain things like the market to solve the problem. We now know national markets don't work the same in an international economy. We've tried some things that I think have not worked, like corporate social responsibility, particularly because there is no enforcement at the workplace. It's all external enforcement because there aren't unions or works councils or someone to make these corporate social responsibility agreements work. Trade's not working, and unions, as you said, have become rather weak. Some of our problems are self-inflicted. Some of them, as we see in China, are inflicted by multinational companies, because I find it rather ironic for all the talk in the United States we are going to China to open up democracy and to, you know, build a different society, and the capitalism would do this. The American Chamber of Commerce and multinational corporations would oppose all the changes that China made to give workers more power to distribute wealth. So there's a level of hypocrisy, I would say, here as well. Yeah, I don't. I look at Trevor. I'm kind of curious to know. I mean, I think the anti-apartheid movement did well when we had sort of the Sullivan principles, when there was sort of a framework for the people who are trying to make change to sort of operate in a common framework. I think there is no way in the world we're going to have local and national unions in a global economy. We are conducting campaigns with other unions in countries like Malawi, where we are enforcing the labor laws of that country. I think we're going to have to see global unionism. I think we're going to see NGOs and foundations and corporations, as I said, you know, come around in terms of something like the Sullivan principles in the 21st century. But in the end, if there's not an independent balance of power, you know, if we just expect noblesse oblige or the markets or trade to work, I think we're seeing it doesn't work. And I'll just leave you with my favorite revolutionary hero statement, which is Alan Greenspan, who says the gap between the rich and the rest of the population is growing so wide and so fast it threatens democratic capitalism.
Annie, I'm going to make a bad pun. You raised China, and you've broken a lot of China in the American labor movement. One of the things you did early, before probably most other national U.S. labor leaders, was to go to China to meet with labor leaders in China with a government-sponsored union. Is there a place? Is there any common ground that you could find with respect to the way workers can organize themselves, even across those very, very diverse platforms and within a democracy versus a government-controlled union?
Yeah, I mean, I've been there now 6 times, and we have now a formal relationship with the ACFTU, which is the only union permitted in China, and people think that's somewhat controversial. Here's my point, and this is why I was so upset with what American, particularly multinational companies, did. You know, there are 170 million workers in unions in China. They're not the kind of unions we know. But they are changing just like the society is changing. You know, there was no market economy. There was no independent government. Things are changing. And if those 170 million people end up, or 250 by the time it's over, 300, in a real organization that can distribute wealth within the country, we will have less inequality. If American corporations or other forces decide they don't want workers to have power inside of it, we will have increasing inequality. So we really have to decide, what is this about our ideology about independent power? Is it about democracy? Is it about sharing wealth? With 170 million people and growing in unions, those unions turning into the right kind of organizations would really help. And American corporations or multinational corporations that operate in China should be expected to promote unions, not kill unions, if it's a way to distribute wealth.
I think another place to watch out for developments there is in Cambodia, where the labor agreement to permit ILO inspectors in the garment industry that was negotiated as formed as a bilateral trade agreement with the U.S. is an interesting example. Trevor, you want to pick up react to the question of the Sullivan principles as a model for changing corporate behavior and around the globe and trying to close this equality gap?
You know, I think we have to address this at a number of different levels. The Sullivan principles arose in circumstances where there was a recalcitrant government, the apartheid government in South Africa. One of the challenges that confronts governments, and let's go back to the issues I raised earlier, governments are collecting too little by way of taxes, largely because multinational corporations are all beneficiaries of double taxation agreements. But even in the U.S., the taxes don't return here. They end up in some other Channel Island. And so the big problem is this U-shape in income distribution. I mean, you're back at levels of the late 70s with the wealthy in society taking out so much more, leaving behind workers. And so that, I think, is a problem. The second issue is that we must empower governments to be able to deal with a series of issues, and I think that with Amartya and Andy, we'd be at idem, that governments must have complementary policies. Globalization on its own does not deliver a change. The peasants are left behind largely. Even wage earners in export-related industries are left behind. Governments must be able to drive changes with infrastructure, with access to finance, with improved quality of public services. All of these are exceedingly important to improving the quality of life measurably of people. And those are the changes. I think that sometimes when we aggregate numbers and we look at per capita GDP and so on, we ignore the fact that there are growing inequalities within society. So in the absence of strong multilateral institutions driven by the same value systems, I think that weak governments are left to their own devices.
Amartya, my friend and former colleague Joe Stiglitz has argued that we have to save globalization from its advocates. And I hear Trevor saying something along those lines similarly. A couple of questions. In order to close the wealth gap, do we have to focus on national policy or the policy of international institutions? Obviously a little bit of both. Where would you place the emphasis? And I guess this is a conference of action. What can people in the audience really do today to build initiatives that encourage more equitable growth, more equitable distribution of income in the world?
Well, I think, as you say, John, that we need both at the national level and the international level. At the national level, of course, Andy emphasized the importance of union and labor movement. But in addition, which I'm very much with him on that, and I only wish the unions had more power in China, but to bear in mind that huge parts of China, there are no unions at all, because there have been no industrial expansion. So when Trevor was mentioning that a whole lot of people have been left out, he mentioned peasants, the whole parts of other people in smaller urban areas were not affected. In China, it's a regionally concentrated thing, to some extent in India too. So I think the role of national policy is huge. And at the same time, the international policy is important, and that's what where Joel Stiglitz's main interests have been, because I think he has been particularly concerned with the fact that rather than helping, some of the international institutions have given exactly the wrong lead to make things worse. And I think he's right to a great extent on that. I think what we have to do is to make sure that we understand what the nature of the problem is. And if I may come back, and since you did give me a chance at the beginning to talk about capabilities and freedom, that what the general public, like people here, have to bear in mind is to recognize, not to admire what's happening just on the basis of some inanimate object expansion like GNP growth, but to really look at what the figures are about literacy, basic health care, infant mortality, child mortality, gender inequality, and see how things are going. And I think there's no question both international institutions as well as the making of national policies are strongly influenced in today's more and more globalized world, which is not just industrially globalized, but also the media and public discussion makes a huge difference. So I think people here taking an interest in things that really matter in the poor countries could, I think, play a very positive part.
So one of the aspects of the surge of growth is we've seen the run-up in commodity prices. Today there's a front-page story in the Wall Street Journal that wheat has doubled in the past, the price of wheat futures has doubled in the past year, hit the highest price ever. We have been unable to reform the international institution with respect to global agricultural trade in the Doha round, but we see a revolution in what's happening partly because of the impact, I think, of moving production, particularly in the United States, from food to fuel through biofuels. I wonder whether – is this a good news story or a bad news story for the world's poor? Do people at the low end who have the capacity to produce going to get more for the fruits of their labor and production, or is it just going to cause more poverty and greater pressure on poor people who won't be able to afford the run-up in the price of commodities? I'd ask maybe Trevor and Martia to both comment on that.
If one looks at the basic grain crops, maize, for example, there's no evidence to suggest that what's happening in this country, where subsidized maize is being diverted to food, actually has a positive impact on small maize growers in developing countries. If you look at countries like Mexico, where the price of tortilla has increased so radically because of the impact of maize price, or pastas in Italy because of the wheat price. Now, you're dealing with a double whammy because the world's second largest producer of wheat, namely Australia, is facing a crippling drought. Diverting food to fuel. I think that the absence of determined action on climate change and the diversion of food to fuel add up to an exceedingly bad news story for food security amongst the world's poorest.
Martin?
I very much endorse that. I think there are two levels at which your question, John, and I'm delighted you came to that at this time because I take it we're ending. A clock going on here.
We started a little late, so go ahead.
But the One are the typical issues, and I must say, I think the maize policy is, I guess in America it's called corn, and that corn policy is, people may not know what the hell Sandler is talking about, but I think there are huge mistakes there. But in addition, I think you raise a very general question. Is benefiting some, and could it be harming others? There are hundreds of policies like that. And that is the nature of the economic game. That whenever you create opportunities, it will make lives of some people better. And in many cases, not invariably, in many cases, it will make other people's lives more difficult. And this is where the vision of public policy comes in. Namely, I mentioned something about the public resource generation and using it for the freedom-enhancing ways in education, healthcare, microcredit, and all the other things that go with it. But it's also a question, I think Trevor, in passing, mentioned that democracy keeps South Africa on the toes, and so it does in India and many other countries. And I think that's why democracy is so important. Because when there are different groups of people involved, some people's interests suffering, some people's interests being enhanced, it's the role of the government, led by a democratic population, to act in a way that the interests of all the people and those who are particularly suffering could be catered to. And it's not an impossible thing to do. As long as you understand what the nature of the problem is, what the challenge is, I think understanding the questions is half the way to answering it. And I think there's an enormous, I remain an optimist, because it seems to me that we are beginning to understand the nature of the problems with much greater clarity than I could see in the discussions even a decade ago.
Well, as Martin noted, we're in the lightning round now, if you've been watching the presidential debate. So I'm going to ask maybe for just some quick closing comments from both President Talabani and Andy Stern. One of the focus here, is particularly in the poverty track, has been on jobs. And so I'd like to ask President Talabani, particularly, I think, with respect in Iraq to the so many displaced persons, now internally in Iraq and externally from Iraq, what's going on now with respect to actually putting people into work? And then, Andy, maybe a closing thought or two on what more needs to be done to get both jobs and wages growing in the United States. We're facing a slowdown here.
Thank you. We suffered too much from the time of dictatorship from unemployment because all factories were stopped and not working. Agriculture was finished. And the government was really only concentrating on the military affairs. As example, at the time of before the dictatorship of Saddam Hussein, we had 36 million palm date. When he finished, we had only 6 million. 30 million were destroyed, and the agriculture was destroyed. So we are starting to first activate our factories for workers, and of course the government is paying the salary of workers who are not also working. But this displacement is the result of the kind of conflict and terrorist activities. Conflict among Sunnis and Shiites was one the main reason, and the other main reason was the activity of terrorists. Terrorist groups were making the trouble, the life of people impossible, ordinary life. So many people were obliged to leave. But I think there is a kind of exaggeration about the number of the, those who are now displaced. It's not 4 million at all. Inside and outside the country, we are estimating that the number is 1.5 million. But also, of course, it's a big number of Iraqi. We had before also the time of dictatorship about 3 million Iraqis outside the country. Some of them came back, some of them are still living in Europe, in the United States, in some Arab countries, in Iran. But now the policy of the government is to try to persuade those people who are living in neighboring countries to come back to their own places. We are suffering from the lack of job for the people because we are, as I told, we are inheriting the government, a dictatorship that we started a plan for example, rebuilding houses for the people, which will mean that we must rebuild hundreds of thousands houses, and it will, of course, help to have 100,000 workers. Also, reactivating Iraqi companies, but not all companies we can reactivate it, because the production is not so good that can, because now we have free market, they cannot be rival to production of the outside, which is coming to Iraq, and it is more better than our productions and cheaper than our production. So this is one of problems we are facing. And we are in need to renew the oil infrastructure everywhere. So it needs money also. Although our economic developed last year, for example, the budget of the government this year is twice than the last year. Now, this year was about $42,000 million. And we have also some other resources for not only the oil. But still we are in the beginning. We start from zero, and we are in beginning to solve all these problems. Many countries around the world are not helping, but in contrary, they are obstructing the development of Iraq, because a democratic, stable, united, federative Iraq will give examples to other people of the Middle East who are suffering from dictatorships, different kinds of dictatorships, so they don't want any success for Iraqi government and people. And this is one of our main problems in the country.
Andy?
Yeah. I mean, John, the gift of America is that people come here from all over the world. They expect to work hard. They hope their work will be rewarded. But the dream is their kids do better than they do. That's been the American dream. It's endured despite recessions, depressions, natural disasters, 42 different presidents, a civil war, and two world wars. And now that dream is at stake. You know, 80% of Americans now think their kids are going to do worse than they are, and that's not the America we want or need. But we need to appreciate this is not our fathers' and grandfathers' economy. We're as far today from the New Deal as the New Deal was from the Civil War. And this global economy requires different challenges, and America has not grappled with it. We are a team. And we need new ideas. The employer-based job situation is over. We are going from employer-managed work lives to self-managed work lives, and yet we have employer-based health care, employer-based pension that are not going to endure over time. We have a tax system that doesn't reward work right now. It rewards wealth. But America needs a plan. And it's not about Democrats and Republicans or business and labor. We need a plan, and we need leadership. And I'm not talking about a Soviet five-year plan. I'm talking about what countries like Ireland did to try to come together and think about their tax system, their education system, their investments as a country. And America in a global economy is a team, and we need to act that way if our kids and grandkids are going to do better than we do.
I think that was a perfect close to a conversation and to a conference that is about team building and new initiative and what we can all do in the nonprofit sector, in the business sector, in the government sector to actually get things going. So thank you, and please once again join me in thanking all the panelists for a really great presentation.
Ladies and gentlemen, the special session is now concluded. The plenary session will begin at 9:15 in the Metropolitan Ballroom. The plenary begins at 9:15 p.m. a.m.